All right, so tonight we're going to read the life of St. Anthony the Great, also known as St. Anthony of Egypt. St. Anthony was one of the first monks and the first who could properly be called a desert father. The desert fathers are this term to describe these monks that would go and live as hermits off by themselves in the desert. And a lot of the wisdom of how to live our life comes from these figures. And St. Anthony was kind of the first of them to go and live as a hermit in the desert. Of course, he was not the first person to do that in the history of the church, in the sense of the history of God's people. We think about John the Baptist. We think about Elijah. And these two figures, Elijah and John the Baptist, and you know, Christ even says that John the Baptist kind of is Elijah, the new covenant version of Elijah, in a sense. These figures, they went off, they lived in the desert. They, it says about John, he ate locusts and wild honey. Elijah, of course, he lived off in the desert, and he had a raven. God sent a raven to bring him food as well. And so there was this model of these figures who were people who were totally dedicated to God. They were unmarried, celibate. They lived lives in total dedication to God as hermits. And so that's the example that these people looked toward. But as we'll read in the life of St. Anthony, at the time that he was becoming a monk, and this would have been about in the middle of the 3rd century-ish, and it doesn't seem like there was much persecution going on right at that time when he was becoming a monk. When he was becoming a monk, there were some people who were already monks. They might not have used that term, monachos. That term in Greek, monachos, which is where monk or monastic comes from, it has this idea of somebody who is alone. That's what the root word there is, mono, like mono in English, the monologue. Prefix, monologue, or whatever, whatever else is mono. And so... yeah, of course. It's kind of funny because in Latin that mono means a monkey. and it's funny because in English we have monk and monkey. It's similar words. Of course, very different things. One is Latin and one is Greek. But in Greek, mono means alone. And so the monahi are those who live alone. But it doesn't always mean they live alone, of course. Sometimes they also live in monasteries. At this time, as we'll read, the monks, the people living as monastics there in Egypt, they would live as hermits. They would live solitary, but they wouldn't live off in the desert. They would kind of live in the town, and live kind of a dedicated celibate life there in the town. But they were still kind of part of their, local Christian community, more in a sense. They weren't a separate monastic community like we would have now, where we have parishes and we have monasteries, and those are different things. So I guess that's pretty much it. Does anybody have any questions just before we begin about anything? I know I didn't send this out ahead of time, so we probably don't have much to go off. But again, just as I had said last time, what we're seeing now is this bridge, in the life of St. Anthony, this bridge from before the legalization of Christianity to after it, it doesn't seem to have affected his life all that much. For whatever reason, maybe because he was in the desert by himself most of the time. But towards the end of his life, he did become more involved in the Arian heresy and fighting that. Now, the author of this is St. Athanasius. St. Athanasius... is the best known theologian who taught against this Arian heresy that Christ is a created being. And this is what the first council, so if, you know, Constantine legalized Christianity in 314, and then in 325, they had this first ecumenical council. And at this first ecumenical council, St. Athanasius was a deacon. He was a deacon, but he was already a very well kind of established theologian. And he ended up being the one who formulated the creed. As we have it in the creed, we say that Christ is of one essence with the Father. And this is something that St. Athanasius proposed and he wrote a lot about. After the council, when they were trying to convince everybody to use the creed, he wrote a lot about it as well. That we have to say that Christ is of one essence with the Father. And this was kind of a contentious thing within Christian circles, because it was something that was non-biblical, this word they used, homoousios, of the same essence. That's not a biblical term. And so St. Athanasius and then the saints following him, St. Basil and others, they basically agreed that it was necessary to explain, it was okay to use non-biblical terms to describe Christ, in order for people to be able to understand what the Bible was saying. So in order to explain and extrapolate and, you know, flesh out what the Bible says about Christ, you might have to use language that's not actually in the Bible, which is, of course, what we do all the time. But at that time, it was a bit contentious. So that's what St. Athanasius is best known for. Later in his life, he himself faced some trials, and he was actually exiled to Germany for a while. When he was, they exiled him from Egypt to Germany because of some things that were going on. But he was a great saint of our church. So anyway, he was somebody, as he says right here in the beginning, that he had been a kind of a student of St. Anthony's and a disciple of his. Yes.
That's the Nicene Creed, right?
Yeah.
There's such a thing as the Apostles' Creed. Were they established at different times?
I don't know as much about the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed was always something that was much more used in the Western part of Europe, Western Europe, France, and Spain. It never really was used all that much in the Greek-speaking Eastern Europe, Southeastern Europe, which then became the Orthodox Church by the 11th century. But the Apostles' Creed is I think sometimes it is attributed to St. Athanasius or something like that, but for whatever reason, it was never really used in the Greek-speaking liturgical tradition.
I had heard from another priest that it was actually written later.
5th century is what I'm seeing right now.
Apostles' Creed. Yeah. It might have been, but... I don't really know that much about it.
Kind of an interesting title for it, given that, but...
Well, right, it's what it is that it's a summary of what the apostles taught, right? And so and we have stuff like that. We have things that are called, like, the apostolic canons, and they're from the 4th century, and again, it's kind of the same idea. The Apostles' Creed is perfectly fine. It just never became part of our liturgical worship for whatever reason. Now, even this first creed at the first ecumenical council is not the creed that we say in church today. We say the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed, which is from the second ecumenical council, because at the second ecumenical council, they decided to add on to and modify a bit the creed from the first council. So we call it the Nicene Creed, and it is the Nicene Creed, but it's actually... the creed from Nicaea plus a little bit more.
Is that why it's the Niceno? Because no is like new?
No. That's just a different way of trying to render the Greek or Latin into English. Yeah. But there's a whole interesting history to that too, where, you know, we say the creed in the liturgy, but we know that that was also kind of a later thing. That's, I think it's from the 6th or 7th century that the creed was actually added to the liturgy. But it was always used the original idea with the creed and with the Apostles' Creed and all these creeds was to be used for receiving people into the church. That was always the primary purpose of these. And then later it was also put into the liturgy because that made sense as well. So yeah, so that's kind of the context of St. Athanasius as this great father, very influential writer in defense of the Orthodox faith and the creed of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. And so that's St. Athanasius. And again, so he was a disciple of St. Anthony. And so we can read about that now. So, Clint, how about you start us... I can read. Clint, how about you start us off with the first paragraph there?
Where do you want me to stop?
It will end there.
You have entered upon a noble rivalry with the monks of Egypt by your determination either to equal or surpass them in your training in the way of virtue. For by this time there are monasteries among you, and the name of monk receives public recognition. With reason, therefore, all men will approve this determination, and in answer to your prayers, God will give it fulfillment. Now, since you asked me to give you an account of the Blessed Anthony's way of life, and are wishful to learn how he began the discipline, who and what manner of man he was previous to this, how he closed his life, and whether the things told of him are true, that you also may bring yourselves to imitate him, I very readily accepted your behest, for to me also the bare recollection of Anthony is a great accession of help. And I know that you, when you have heard, apart from your admiration of the man, will be wishful to emulate his determination, seeing that for monks the life of Anthony is a sufficient pattern of discipline. Wherefore, do not refuse credence to what you have heard from those who brought tidings of him, but think rather that they have told you only a few things. For at all events, they scarcely can have given circumstances of so great import in any detail. And because I, at your request, have called to mind a few circumstances about him, and shall send as much as I can tell in a letter, do not neglect to question those who sail from here, for possibly when all have told their tale, the account will hardly be in proportion to his merits. On account of this, I was desirous, when I received your letter, to send for certain of the monks, those especially who were wont to be more frequently with him, that if I could learn any fresh details, I might send them to you. But since the season for sailing is coming to an end and the letter carrier urgent, I hasten to write to your piety what I myself know, having seen him many times and what I was able to learn from him. For I was his attendant for a long time and poured water on his hands, in all points being mindful of the truth, that no one should disbelieve through hearing too much, nor, on the other hand, by hearing too little, should despise the man.
Okay, thank you. So that's a kind of run-on thought there, but let's see. So it says, Athanasius, the bishop to the brethren in foreign parts. So these monks in other regions, I've heard about the monks of Egypt. And he says, for by this time there are monasteries among you, and the name of monk receives public recognition. And he says, okay, so you guys, you have monasteries and monks, and you want to learn about St. Anthony's way of life. And he says, sure, I can help you, because it's also helpful for me to have this recollection of Anthony. of course, and then he says everybody would like to emulate or imitate his determination, seeing that for monks the life of Anthony is a sufficient pattern of discipline. So again, when we think about the context of this, you know, he's talking about, for by this time there are monasteries among you. You know, at the beginning of Anthony's life, there weren't really monasteries. There were a couple kind of people living kind of as monks here and there, but there weren't really monasteries. St. Anthony lived 105 years. he lived to 105 years old, and St. Athanasius knew him when he was very old already. Then this is some years after his death, and so this is a very long time after... this is probably 100 years or so after where this story is going to start with Anthony as an 18-year-old, basically. And so, you know, so by this time there are monasteries, but at that time there weren't. And so he says, okay, so I wrote you a letter. I hasten to write what I know. And he says, and I'm being mindful of the truth, that no one should disbelieve through hearing too much, nor on the other hand, by hearing too little, should despise the man. So what he means by that is, you know, if I tell you so many things about miracles and things like that, you might not even believe it. But if he says, if I don't tell you enough, then you're just going to think, okay, he's just some other guy. And so he's saying, well, I'll just tell you the truth, and this is the truth about St. Anthony. So it says, birth and beginnings of Anthony. Nathan, could you read that paragraph?
Anthony, you must know, was by descent an Egyptian. His parents were of good family and possessed considerable wealth. And as they were Christians, he also was reared in the same faith. In infancy, he was brought up with his parents, knowing not else but them and his home. But when he was grown and arrived at boyhood and was advancing in years, he could not endure to learn letters, not caring to associate with other boys. But all his desire was, as it is written of Jacob, to live a plain man at home. Genesis 25:27. With his parents, he used to attend the Lord's house, and neither as a child was he idle, nor when he older did he despise them, but was both obedient to his father and mother, and was attentive to what he read, keeping in his heart what was profitable in what he heard. As though as a child brought up in moderate affluence, he did not trouble his parents for varied and luxurious fare, nor was this a source of pleasure to him, but was content simply with what he found, nor sought anything further.
Okay, thank you. So this is just kind of the, background about him. So he was from a good and kind of wealthy family, and they were Christians, and... But then as a child, he was already not really interested in, pursuing a career, learning, secular things or whatever. But he was very into, going to services, being obedient to his parents. And he was content with what he had. Sometimes there are children like this. You know, some kids are just naturally... like this, and some aren't, but that's just how it is. There are many saints who weren't like this as children, and there were many saints who were like this as children, so that's just how it is. Alright, so then I'll go on here. Mark, could you read number 2?
After the death of his father and mother, he was left alone with one little sister. His age was about 18 or 20, and on him the care both of home and sister rested. Now, it was not 6 months after the death of his parents, and going according to custom into the Lord's house, he communed with himself and reflected as he walked how the apostles, Matthew 4:20, left all and followed the Savior, and how they in the Acts 4:35 sold their possessions and brought and laid them at the apostles' feet for distribution to the needy, and what and how great a hope was laid up for them in heaven. Pondering over these things, he entered the church, and it happened the gospel was being read, And he heard the Lord saying to the rich man, Matthew 19:21, if you would be perfect, go and sell that you have and give to the poor, and come follow me, and you shall have treasure in heaven. Anthony, as though God had put him in minds of the saints and the passage had been read on his account, went out immediately from the church and gave the possessions of his forefathers to the villagers. They were 300 acres, productive and very fair, that they should be no more a clog upon himself and his sister. And all the rest that was movable he sold, and having got together much money, he gave it to the poor, reserving a little, however, for his sister's sake.
Okay. So we hear that, you know, Saint Anthony, when Saint Anthony was, about 18 or 20, and his parents had passed, not even 6 months after they had passed, he went and he heard this gospel reading. And he was already thinking about how, he didn't have any attachment to all these possessions and all this wealth he had inherited, all this land. He was already thinking about this, and it happened that Sunday the gospel being read was, if you would be perfect, go and sell all that you have and give it to the poor, and come, follow me, and you shall have treasure in heaven. Saint Anthony, hearing this, he went out and he did that. Sometimes it's hard for us. We think, oh, I should do this. To be a Christian, I should do this, I should do that. that's a nice idea, but, practically, blah, blah, blah. He took this very to heart and just said, okay, I'm going to sell all that I have and give it to the poor. And we see he didn't get rid of all of his money, because he did leave some for his sister, for her to inherit. And so he took care of his, made sure his sister was okay. But then he gave all the rest of all this wealth. 300 acres, that's, it's a lot of land. That's a nice, very nice sized farm. And he gave all this up. So, when we think about us, do we hear what's said in the gospel and really take it to heart like that? Not just this passage, but every passage that we hear. But we see that somebody like St. Anthony, that's what he did. He heard the gospel and he said, okay, that's what I'll do. And he went and he did it. He didn't make excuses. He didn't, plan to do it later or something like that, but he just went and did it right away. But that being said, he did also take care of his family too, which is what we do. All right, so St. Anthony's early ascetic life. Noah, could you read number 3? You can read it. Yeah.
And again, as he went into the church, hearing the Lord say in the gospel, be not anxious for the morrow. He could stay no longer, but went out and gave those things also to the poor. Having committed his sister to known and faithful virgins and put her into a convent to be brought up, he henceforth devoted himself outside his house to discipline, taking heed to himself and training himself with patience. For there were not yet so many monasteries in Egypt, and no monk at all knew of the distant desert, but all who wished to give heed to themselves practiced the discipline in solitude near their own village. Now there was then in the next village an old man who had lived the life of a hermit from his youth up. Anthony, after he had seen this man, imitated him in piety. And at first he began to abide in the places outside the village. Then if he heard of a good man anywhere, like the prudent bee, he went forth and sought him, nor turned his back to his own palace until he had seen him. And he returned, having got from the good man, as it were, supplies for his journey in the way of virtue. So dwelling there at first, he confirmed his purpose not to return to the abode of his fathers, nor to the remembrance of his kinsfolk, but to keep all his desire and energy for perfecting his discipline. He worked, however, with his hands, having heard, he who is idle, let him not eat, and part he spent on bread, and part he gave to the needy. And he was constant in prayer, knowing that a man ought to pray in secret unceasingly. For he had given such heed to what was read that none of the things that were written fell from him to the ground, but he remembered all, and afterwards his memory served him for books.
So he he did what's very hard to do, and he listened in church all the time, and he remembered everything he heard in church. But what he had heard, he remembered, and then afterward, he didn't even really need books. He had all this in his memory. And he said, it says here too, he was praying in secret unceasingly. So there's this idea of inner prayer, this idea that we should be praying all the time. You know, whether we're, anytime we're at work, we're driving in our car, we're doing whatever we're doing, we can always take a moment to remember God. This is something that he was doing at this time in, you know, the 3rd century, and we're doing still, you know, 1700 years later. That we remember God. And so he was constant in prayer. And so we hear that St. Anthony, he didn't go to one of these, there were these kind of monks living in villages, or maybe there were a couple even monasteries, but nobody was living as a hermit, totally distant, it says. And so he went over to the next village. There was a man who lived there in the village who kind of lived as a monk, as a hermit, but he didn't live out in the desert in the village. And so St. Anthony imitated this man, and then he began to imitate other people too. He began to go about, it says, like a bee. You know, this image of a bee is often used in the spiritual life, where a bee goes about from flower to flower to gather nectar to make honey. And a bee, goes to these flowers and gathers what is good and takes that. That's what we're called to do as Christians. We find what is good and we bring that in to ourselves. And we'll get more on this here in a second, in the next paragraph. So he's beginning to live as a monk. And he's kind of living in a village, or he's going from village to village. Let me get to number 4. Melissa, could you read number 4?
Thus conducting himself, Anthony was beloved by all. He subjected himself in sincerity to the good men whom he visited and learned thoroughly where each surpassed him in zeal and discipline. He observed the graciousness of one, the unceasing prayer of another. He took knowledge of another's freedom from anger and another's loving kindness. He gave heed to one as he watched, to another as he studied. One he admired for his endurance, another for his fasting and sleeping on the ground. The piety towards Christ and the mutual love which animated all. Thus filled, he returned to his own place of discipline, and henceforth would strive to unite the qualities of each, and was eager to show in himself the virtues of all. With others of the same age, he had no rivalry, save this only, that he should not be second to them in higher things. And this he did so as to hurt the feelings of nobody, but made them rejoice over him. So all they of that village and the good men in whose intimacy he was, when they saw that he was a man of this sort, used to call him God beloved, and some welcomed him as a son, others as a brother.
Thank you. So it says that, you know, Anthony, he was going about, it says he subjected himself in sincerity to the good men whom he visited. Again, in the tradition of the church, it's very important to look to real people that we interact with and to see the good things in them. Nowadays, unfortunately, people find out about Orthodoxy online, and that's not always the best thing, because we don't get that real connection with people. But of course, when we come to church and we connect with people. That's very good. And so what Anthony would do is he would go to these people who had been living kind of as monastics, and he would go and visit them. And he would see that, you know, one was gracious, another had unceasing prayer, another had freedom from anger, another had loving kindness, another one would sleep on the ground, another one was meek. But it says that St. Athanasius says, he says, while Anthony, he took note of the piety towards Christ and the mutual love which animated all. So all of them have piety towards Christ, all of them have love, because that's what we all have as Christians. But then with these other things, that some of them were better than others in different ways. And I think this is a very good lesson for us. Again, it's very easy, you know, to go through life and say, this person is negative in this way, this person is negative in that way. I don't like this person because of this. I don't like this person because of that. And we should be doing the exact opposite, right? We should be saying, this person has this great characteristic that I don't have. You know, I should imitate them in this way. This other person has some other, you know, positive trait that I can imitate as well. And so that's the way we should be going through life, just like St. Anthony's doing here. We're not going around and finding what's negative in everyone, but we're going around and finding what's positive in everyone. And, you know, it says, you know, some, you know, we're really good at, you know, fasting or something like that. And so, well, that doesn't mean the other ones, you know, maybe the other ones maybe weren't as good at that or something, but that's okay. Because, again, what we do in life is we look to see what people do positively well, and we try to imitate that. Again, this kind of second part here, it says, with others of the same age, he had no rivalry, save this only, that he should not be second to them. I mean, I don't think that means that he was, like, competing to be a better monk. I don't think we should understand it that way. I think what the author is saying is that, you know, that just in a sense that he was already kind of very mature for his age. I think that's simply what he's saying. It's not meant to be taken that way.
I think if you were competing, they wouldn't. The last part of that wouldn't be true. He did it. You know, he didn't hurt anybody's feelings, and everybody was like,
yeah. They all rejoiced over him, and so he was. If he was being a very exceptional monk, he was doing it earnestly. He wasn't just doing it to look that way or something. But again, you know, so he would kind of go around to these different villages where people were living as monks,
and gather the best. So it's an early conflicts with the devil. Sarah, could you read that one, number 5?
But the devil, who hates and envies what is good, could not endure to see such a resolution in a youth, but endeavored to carry out against him what he had been wont to effect against others. First of all, he tried to lead him away from the discipline, whispering to him the remembrance of his wealth, care for his sister, claims of kindred, love of money, love of glory, the various pleasures of the table, and the other relaxations of life, and at last, the difficulty of virtue and the labor of it. He suggested also the infirmity of the body and the length of time. In a word, he raised in his mind a great dust of debate, wishing to debar him from his settled purpose. But when the enemy saw himself to be too weak for Anthony's determination, and that he rather was conquered by the other's firmness, overthrown by his great faith, and falling through his constant prayers, then at length putting his trust in the weapons which are in the navel of his belly, and boasting in them, for they are his first snare for the young, he attacked the young man, disturbing him by night and harassing him by day, so that even the onlookers saw the struggle which was going on between them. The one would suggest foul thoughts, and the other counter them with prayers. The one fire him with lust, the other, as one who seemed to blush, fortify his body with faith, prayers, and fasting. And the devil, unhappy wight, one night he even took upon him the shape of a woman and imitated all her acts, simply to beguile Anthony. But he, his mind filled with Christ and the nobility inspired by him, and considering the spirituality of the soul, quenched the coal of the other's deceit. Again, the enemy suggested the ease of pleasure, but he, like a man filled with rage and grief, turned his thoughts to the threatened fire and the gnawing worm, and setting these in array against his adversary, passed through the temptation unscathed. All this was a source of shame to his foe, for he, deeming himself like God, was now mocked by a young man, and he who boasted himself against flesh and blood was being put to flight by a man in the flesh. For the Lord was working with Anthony, the Lord who for our sake took flesh and gave the body victory over the devil, so that all who truly fight can say, not I, but the grace of God which was with me.
So we hear that St. Anthony, you know, these kinds of first big temptations he's facing. He's about 20 or so years old. And so the devil attacks him with this idea of pleasure, and it's not just, idea of women or lust or whatever, but it's also just the idea of pleasure in general. At first saying, oh, it's better to live in the world, and you had all this wealth, you know, that kind of thing, and then also tempting him with other kinds of pleasure. And so we see here that what St. Anthony does to fight this is he prays. He has his mind filled with Christ, it says. And the more he was, the Satan was trying to tempt him with these thoughts, it says he turned his own thoughts to the fire and the gnawing worm. Sometimes we don't, as Christians, there's kind of a negative perception that Christians are always talking about hell and hellfire and demons and worms and all this stuff. But and we try not to talk about that too much, because I don't think that's what we should emphasize the goodness of heaven over the terror of hell, in a sense. I think that's more important. But in these kinds of moments, if we're being, Satan is tempting us, we have demons tempting us to do things that are wrong. That's good to remember, hellfire and things like that. That's kind of how it functions for us, right? Is, okay, well, if I do these things that are evil and wrong, and I turn my back on God and all these things, then maybe that's where I'm going to end up, And so it's important to have that in mind. Obviously, we want to focus on the goodness of God, giving thanks to God for the eternal life of heaven, of paradise. And we don't want to focus on, oh, we're just trying to get out of hell. We're trying to, be with God eternally. But it's also useful to think that way as well. So we see that the devil is tempting him with these kinds of things. Then we'll see that he kind of tries different things. Okay, it's an interesting passage. All right. Matt, go ahead.
At last, when the dragon could not even thus overthrow Anthony, but saw himself thrust out of his heart, gnashing his teeth as it is written, and as it were beside himself, he appeared to Anthony like a black boy, taking a visible shape in accordance with the color of his mind, and cringing to him, as it were, he plied him with thoughts, no longer for guileful as he was. He had been worsted, but at last spoke in human voice and said, many I deceived, many I cast down, but now attacking you and your labors, as I had many others, I proved weak. When Anthony asked, who are you who speak thus with me? He answered with a lamentable voice, I am the friend of whoredom, and have taken upon me enticements which led to it against the young. I am called the spirit of lust. How many have I deceived who wish to live soberly? How many are the chaste whom by my incitements I have over-persuaded? I am he on account of whom also the prophet reproves those who have fallen, saying, Hosea 4:12, you have been caused to err by the spirit of whoredom. For by me they have been tripped up. I am he who have so often troubled you and have so often been overthrown by you. But Anthony, having given thanks to the Lord with good courage, said to him, You are very despicable then, for you are black-hearted and weak as a child. Henceforth I shall have no trouble from you. For the Lord is my helper, and I shall look down on mine enemies. Having heard this, the black one straightway fled, shuddering at the words and dreading any longer even to come near the man.
So we hear that the devil appears to Anthony and has this conversation with him. It says he appears like a black boy. This might sound racist or something to us nowadays, but I don't think we should interpret it that way. Because in Greek, in English, we call people who are African or African-American, we call them black, but of course their skin is not black, it's brown, just like our skin is not white, it's pink. And so this is not supposed to mean an African boy. It's supposed to mean somebody with black, like jet black, which is not human color, obviously. But this is supposed to be a kind of demonic jet black color. And so when he says that he appears with this kind of jet black appearance, and he says, "Oh, I proved weak against you." And he says, "I'm the spirit of lust," and, you know, and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I try to incite people and persuade them. And we know this, you know, we know that many people, in their youth, they're incited by these bodily pleasures, and they give up on religion and trying to live well and all these things. And so, you know, this is always kind of one of the basic temptations. But Anthony overcame this temptation by God's grace. And as he says, "The Lord is my helper, and I shall look down on mine enemies." And so that the devil departs from him at first. But then he comes back. All right, so... number 7, Clint, could you read that one again?
This was Anthony's first struggle against the devil, or rather this victory was the Savior's work in Anthony, who condemned sin in the flesh, that the ordinance of the law might be fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. But neither did Anthony, although the evil one had fallen, henceforth relax his care and despise him. Nor did the enemy, as though conquered, cease to lay snares for him. For he went round as a lion seeking some occasion against him. But Anthony, having learned from the scriptures that the devices of the devil are many, zealously continued the discipline, reckoning that though the devil had not been able to deceive his heart by bodily pleasure, he would endeavor to ensnare him by other means. For the demon loves sin. Wherefore, more and more he repressed the body and kept it in subjection, lest, haply having conquered on one side, he should be dragged down on the other. He therefore planned to accustom himself to a severer mode of life. And many marveled, but he himself used to bear the labor easily. For the eagerness of soul, through the length of time it had abode in him, had wrought a good habit. In him, so that taking but little initiation from others, he showed great zeal in this matter. He kept vigil to such an extent that he often continued the whole night without sleep, and this not once but often, to the marvel of others. He ate once a day after sunset, sometimes once in 2 days, and often even in 4. His food was bread and salt, his drink water only. Of flesh and wine it is superfluous even to speak, since no such thing was found with the other earnest men. A rush mat served him to sleep upon, but for the most part he lay upon the bare ground. He would not anoint himself with oil, saying it behooved young men to be earnest in training and not to seek what would enervate the body, but they must accustom it to labor, mindful of the apostles' words, "When I am weak, then I am strong." "For," said he, "the fiber of the soul is then sound when the pleasures of the body are diminished." And he had come to this truly wonderful conclusion, that progress in virtue and retirement of the world for the sake of it ought not to be measured by time, but by desire and fixity of purpose. He at least gave no thought to the past, but day by day, as if he were at the beginning of his discipline, applied greater pains for advancement, often repeating to himself the saying of Paul, "Forgetting the things which are behind and stretching forward to the things which are before." He was also mindful of the words spoken by the prophet Elias, "The Lord lives before whose presence I stand today." For he observed that in saying today, the prophet did not compute the time that had gone by, but daily, as though ever commencing, he eagerly endeavored to make himself fit to appear before God. Before God, being pure in heart and ever ready to submit to his counsel and to him alone. And he used to say to himself that from the life of the great Elias, the hermit ought to see his own as in a mirror.
Thank you. Yeah, you had two long paragraphs. Sorry, Clint.
Really working me out today.
Yeah. So that Elias or Elijah, a prophet. And so this is kind of describing, it was a long paragraph here, but it's kind of describing what St. Anthony started doing. And so he said, okay, he recognized that, you know, he had overcome kind of this first temptation. But he did not relax his care and despise him. And the enemy did not cease to lay snares in front of him, or for him. For again, he, the Satan, went round as a lion seeking some occasion against him. And it says, and Anthony realized this, and he knew that Satan would endeavor to ensnare him by other means. So wherefore, more and more, St. Anthony, he repressed his body and kept it in subjection. This is what we're doing when we're fasting. You know, we're teaching ourselves discipline. We're using our will to cut off our bodily desires to eat steak every day, or whatever that is, you know. And so we're using, we use fasting as a tool to discipline our bodies and have our mind in control of our body and not vice versa. And so that's what St. Anthony does here. And so he does a severer mode of life. So it says at first, he kept vigil. That doesn't mean the service of vigil, but that means that we would do now and we would call vigil, but that means praying at night is essentially what keeping vigil means. He kept vigil to such an extent that he often continued the whole night without sleep, and this not once but often to the marvel of others. He ate once a day after sunset, sometimes once in 2 days, and often even in four. His food was bread and salt, his drink water only. And so he was very strict with his prayers and with sleep and eating. Yes?
Does that mean he didn't sleep at all, or just that he stayed up at night and then slept other times, like took naps or something?
I don't know. I don't know what that would mean, yeah. I know that, so in nowadays, kind of what's done is that monks will pray often through the night for many hours and they'll split their sleep.
Okay.
So kind of one of the most rigorous, best-known monks of the 20th century, St. Joseph the Hesychast, what they would do is they would sleep for like 2 or 3 hours in the evening, and they would pray for like, 8 hours all night, mm-hmm. like going to work, basically, every 8 hours. And then they would sleep for like another like 3 or so hours after that. So I don't know if that's exactly what they would do then. I'm not really sure. But but this idea of praying at night is a very ancient practice. And we talked about this before, I think, too, that even, we do the liturgy Sunday morning. We have our services like every other Christian church does nowadays, have our services in Sunday morning. But originally the Christians would pray, they'd gather Saturday evening and they'd pray through the night all the way until sunrise on Sunday morning. So there's this idea that they would do this, these monks would do this kind of every day. And so we hear, he would kind of sleep. He'd either have a mat of rushes, like hay, basically, or he'd just lay on the ground. He did all this, again, he did all this because he knew that Satan was going to keep tempting him. As long as he was trying to live this fully committed Christian life, Satan was going to keep tempting him. And that's a good lesson for us. We're not trying to live as monks in Egypt, but we are trying to live committed Christian lives. And as long as we're doing that, there will be temptations. You know, we can't We can't expect that, I overcame this one temptation, now I'm never going to have any more temptations. You know, we have to keep expecting that new things will come up. There always will be something. Maybe we'll go for a couple of weeks or months or something without any newer temptations. There's always something that is going to be, a struggle. And so we should always expect that. All right, so I think we can. How far are we? I think we're going to stay there today. We've been going for 50 minutes, so I think we could end there. That'd be good.